Okay, we're pleased to welcome Patrick French to the Yesu Prasad Centre for Caribbean Studies to talk to us about his work on Caribbean literature and history, and specifically the life of V.S. Naipaul. Naipaul, of course, was the subject of Patrick's award-winning biography, The World Is What It Is, 2008. And this book offers a compelling, nuanced and highly revealing account of the Nobel Prize-winning Trinidadian author. In addition to this biography of a hugely significant but famously difficult writer, Patrick French is also the author of Young Husband, The Last Great Imperial Adventurer, Tibet, Tibet, A Personal History of a Lost Land, and two highly regarded books on India. Of particular interest to us at the Yesu Prasad Centre is his understanding of Naipaul's involvement in the BBC radio programme Caribbean Voices, and more widely in the network of Caribbean and Black British writers living in London in the post-war years.
So, hello Patrick, and again, you know, thanks very much for agreeing to speak to us, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to the centre.
Okay, thank you. Hello, Chris and Mike. It's great to be here and to be able to speak about a subject that fascinates me.
So I think we were going to begin just by asking you to explain a bit about the genesis of your interest in kind of Caribbean literature and in Naipaul specifically.
I suppose my interest in Naipaul as a writer probably originated with reading his books on India. And I then, by the time I started doing the biography, I hadn't read everything he'd written. A book like The Middle Passage, for example, I hadn't read. I'd had a rather unfortunate experience with The Middle Passage. I was carrying it on a small boat when I was shipwrecked off the coast of Kenya. And the book and my possessions ended up in the sea. And after about 3 hours in the water, we made land and all survived. And so whenever I saw the book after that, I slightly avoided it. But to be honest with you, I didn't know much about Caribbean literature. But as I researched the biography, I became more and more interested in it. And in particular, not only the radio programme Caribbean Voices and the role of Henry Swansea, but in particular what came directly before that in the 1930s and 40s, leading to this extraordinary kind of flowering or explosion of writers, poets, novelists. It is really incredible to think that in London in the 1950s, there were so many of these young writers from different countries who would go on to make remarkable reputations. I guess Naipaul and Walcott are probably the best known, but there were really dozens of others.
Maybe we can ask a bit about, particularly kind of before Naipaul gets to England, and in particular his relationship with his father, because so much of your own book on Naipaul in the early part of that book turns on Naipaul's relationship with his father, his kind of view of Supersad Naipaul.
Yes.
So I'm wondering whether you could say a bit more about the importance of this relationship to Naipaul, and in particular the importance of his father's own writing career to Naipaul's subsequent fiction and attitudes.
Well, I think it's important to bear in mind that when V.S. Naipaul was growing up in the 1930s and 40s, aspiring writers were very limited in terms of what they could do, where they could publish. The idea of being a commercial or somebody who could live from their writing was completely impossible. And his father clearly had ambition and I think a lot of talent as well. And what tended to happen was that during the course of V.S. Naipaul's career, he went back again and again in fiction and in non-fiction to the figure of his father. You get it in Prologue to an Autobiography, you get it in The Mimic Men, you get it in various speeches and essays. He very much elevated the idea of his father as somebody who had given everything to literature, who believed that literature was a noble calling. He would describe how in Petty Valley, in Trinidad, this rural place that they moved to, which was living as part of his mother's extended family in a way that he didn't like, how they would sit there and they would read Maupassant or Charles Dickens together. And it was almost as if the pair of them, this little unit, separated themselves off from the discord and the squalor around them and lived in some imaginary land of stagecoaches driving through England in the days of, you know, Dickens or whatever it was. But to a quite considerable extent, I realised when I wrote The World Is What It Is, that was a fiction. His father was emotionally fragile. His life was a mess for a lot of the time when his children were growing up. And it was really Draupadi, his mother, and her family that provided the base, the solidity, the education that enabled him to be one of the winners of the, I think it was 3 or 4 annual scholarships to then send him to Oxford in his late teens. So although his father is a crucial figure in his presentation of himself, without the practical assistance of his mother and her sisters and mother, Naipaul's grandmother, I think none of his achievement would have been possible. Shall I also just say something about his father's actual writing?
Yeah.
Which I remember when I interviewed him about his father, and he would talk about some of the contemporaries that his father had, people like Herbert Delisa or Alfred Mendes, C.L.R. James in particular, somebody who Sipasad Naipaul felt had got into print before him and done things before him, and he was always a little bit jealous, I think, of him. But Naipaul, when I interviewed him, would tend to get a little bit angry about what he felt was the unjustified neglect of his father. And despite the fact that he had posthumously produced his tale, Gurudeva and other tales, in various forms, nobody had really taken it seriously. They'd regarded it as folk writing. He felt that Indian critics in particular didn't realise this was important Indian diaspora fiction. Instead, it was just a little quaint curiosity from a faraway island. And I have to say, I think that Naipaul was right in that. And so I'm just going to read a paragraph from Gurudeva and Other Indian Tales. So here you have Gurudeva collecting and preparing sticks for stick fighting, which was a thing that Trinidadian Indians enjoyed doing. He would take himself into the high woods up in Chikland, 3 miles away, and cut the puis that flourished abundantly on the highland, and gathering them in a bundle, he would tote them home. Out in the yard, he would make a blazing fire of dry leaves, and bake the sticks in it, and beat the barks off them on the ground. Then he would cut each stick into the desired length, from ground level to his lower ribs, and then with cutlass, with broken bottles with razor-sharp edges, and finally, with sandpaper, he would impart to each stick the smoothness and uniformity of a ruler. Then he would go to the giant bamboo clump nearby and bring forth a length of bamboo, stout and ripe and roomy in its hollowness, and an inch or two longer than his stick. And he would punch out all the compartments but the last, and order Ratni to make enough oil from coconuts and fill the bamboo vessel with it to the very top. Into the bamboo he would immerse as many of his precious sticks as it could hold. Then he would stand the vessel in a corner of his room, and would not bring out the sticks from it till 10 days or a fortnight, when he would let off a whoop of joy. For the sticks would be found to have taken on a rich brown colour, and almost twice the weight they had before their protracted bath. Now, I think that is really beautiful, classical writing. It tells you a huge amount of information about a tradition or a custom that you would otherwise know nothing about, and it's done really economically.
Yeah.
It's the kind of passage that a lesser writer would have extended over 5 pages. So I think although Naipaul romanticises his father, in purely literary terms that may be justified, and the style of writing you can immediately see influenced Naipaul's own style.
It's an interesting paradox in a way that Sipasad Naipaul's work is often, like you mentioned, it wasn't kind of understood within that tradition almost of the kind
Absolutely.
Of the big Trinidadian burst of short stories like James and Mendes and Gomez and you know the people around Beacon and so on.
Yes.
Whereas Naipaul is kind of linked to that, V.S. Naipaul is linked to that, and yet wanted to kind of separate himself off from it, which
Absolutely.
Which he does with Miguel Street in a kind of interesting way, I suppose. Okay, well, I wonder if we could move from one important paternal figure, perhaps to another that kind of occupies that same position. And you've mentioned already the figure of Henry Swansea,
yes,
the Irish producer of the BBC radio programme Caribbean Voices. And as you show in your biography, Swansea was a key influence in terms of material financial support for Naipaul when he arrives in London.
And I think of Derek Walcott.
And Walcott, yeah. And Lamming, and Selvon, and all of these, yes, these writers. And obviously Swansea is also central in providing an outlet for literary ambitions. Could you say a little bit about the relationship between these two men as Naipaul saw it?
I think that because it came at a particular point in his life when he was very ambitious in a way that probably seemed a little impractical, the idea of somebody coming from Trinidad to Oxford, graduating, making a reputation as a writer in London was really impossible. I mean, it was very unlikely that it would go further. So in that sense, Henry Swansea was important as a father figure, somebody who connected to his own father and was in contact with his own father before his death. Absolutely critical. And I think without Caribbean Voices, Naipaul would not have had that break. And who knows, he might may have done it another way, but he himself felt that it was really a mechanism of survival, being able to do stuff for Caribbean Voices as a programme. And I think that Swansea was important really most of all because he took the writing that was coming out of the Caribbean completely seriously on its own terms. He didn't do what many people in Britain were doing at that time, which is to be dismissive or to regard it only as a curiosity. He was genuinely interested in what was coming out. And I think that that itself connects in quite an interesting way to the sort of education that most of those West Indian writers who were born, let's say, in the 20s, 30s and 40s had, which tended to be very traditional, quite often modelled on the English or British grammar school or boarding school idea of how education should work. For example, the fact that at school, at somewhere like somewhere like QRC in Port of Spain or in other equivalent schools, of which admittedly there were not very many, there was an absolute standard, which was that you did things in the proper and correct way. The articulation of words, elocution, standard English, all of this was taught in a quite a rigid way. Outside school, obviously, you might speak in dialect or in any way you wanted. And when you went back home, you might speak in a third language. You might speak in some version of Hindi or some version of Chinese, for example. So that sort of very strict tradition, if you like, is, I think, very important to understanding the way that those writers thought and wrote. So although they were completely breaking ground in terms of what their later achievement would be, it came out of quite a solid foundation. And I think that if you look at somebody like C.L.R. James, who was a teacher at QRC at one point, when you had people starting to write about C.L.R. James sort of 50 years later, I think sometimes it didn't fully, you know, become apparent what somebody like that came out of. Mm. You know, people were curious about the fact that he was a lover of Verdi or that he was a lover of Thackeray's Vanity Fair. They thought it was kind of unexpected, and yet if you were part of that generation, it was absolutely expected. You might still sing calypsos, but you'd like Verdi.
Mm. And that sort of paradox in James comes out perhaps most obviously in the Letters from London.
Yes,
where he's a journalist writing back to Trinidad, and that's where you get that strange mix of a kind of Victorian gent in one sense,
absolutely,
and a burgeoning Marxist thinker,
yeah,
towards,
yeah,
the,
yeah,
end of those letters.
No, in that way that he writes about people like T.S. Eliot and, you know, and then he writes about the English natives in London and how they behave and why their houses are all close together.
And
so,
and small,
yeah,
and
yeah. I mean, you know, it's fascinating, really, that he was writing in that way at that time. Mm. And again, I think that Sipasad Naipaul was very conscious that James had gone to London and he'd done that, whereas Sipasad never left Trinidad, so it wasn't an experience that he ever had himself.
In terms of, one of the, obviously one of the kind of the breaks that Swansea gave to Naipaul was after Swansea left Caribbean Voices, he was seconded to Ghana. Naipaul took over the editorship of Caribbean Voices. We're wondering whether you could say something about perhaps the differences between Naipaul's and Swansea's editorship of the programme, anything that kind of, you know, really distinguished Naipaul's tenure.
Just one other thing to add to what we were saying just now is that another important figure in terms of Sipasad Naipaul, V.S. Naipaul, his early self-perception was Sam Selvon and the achievement that he had. Again, it was, you know, how has Selvon managed to do it when I haven't quite got there? You know, added to which was the fact that at one stage Sam Selvon and Kamla, later Kamla Tiwari, who's unfortunately died since the book came out, since The World Is What It Is came out, that they had a relationship. So there were all sorts of, not only intellectual or cultural or creative strings between these different people, there was also the personal link. The personal relationships between those writers were, I think, very important. But in terms of the editorship, I don't know if any particular change was discernible. Naipaul's main job during the four-year period when he was there was presenting. Editing and producing tended to shift between other people. And I think at one point he was technically the editor. But the actual sort of form or idea of the programme didn't change in any way that I could discern. I may be wrong about that, and of course it folded relatively soon afterwards. But certainly his idea of Caribbean Voices seemed to very much come from Swansea.
Yeah.
One more sort of Henry Swansea question in particular. In reading Henry Swansea's own diaries, he mentions in several places around the time that Naipaul's about to take over the presenting of Caribbean Voices in 1954, before Swansea leaves for Ghana, he mentions several times that he sees the BBC and these programmes in particular functioning rather like a university for the writers involved.
I thought that's
quite interesting, given that Naipaul, as you outline in The World Is What It Is, has said, you know, on record that he felt he learned nothing at Oxford. Do you think Swansea gets it right? Was Caribbean Voices that higher educative experience?
I suppose it was, actually, yeah. I mean, you know, of course Naipaul did gain things from Oxford, but he probably gained more from Caribbean Voices. I think the fact that there was a very sort of high expectation and that people really believed in what they were doing was very important to him. I think if it had been more of an amorphous programme where they had less social interaction or where people were less bothered about achievement, then it wouldn't have suited him. But in fact, he was completely socially part of that group of people. Although, of course, later in the early 1960s, he very deliberately cut away from them.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, one of the things that Naipaul was attracted to about The World of Caribbean Voices, which I think in a large part is due to Swansea, is this idea of literary value and standard.
And excellence, yeah.
Could you talk to us a little bit, perhaps, about how Naipaul negotiated between the pressures brought to bear by the BBC regarding judgments around literary value and the material that he then received for broadcast on the programme? Did he have to mediate when he was in that presenting?
I suppose he did. I mean, I know that he was occasionally dismissive of people who then ended up actually not necessarily going on to be writers, but normally having some academic connection with literature. He was very conscious among the names who he thought was good and who he thought wasn't good. Someone like Jan Karu, for example, who he liked personally but didn't particularly rate. And then there were others who, I remember when I was interviewing him, he could quite happily quote their poetry. He would remember you know, line after line of things that people had written at that time and then broadcast on the programme. Of, you know, perhaps Derek Walcott would be the best known example. He was able to quote early Walcott, and again, his later comments on Walcott and Walcott's comments on him very much come out of a personal antagonism that sort of unfurled over the next half century. And perhaps another thing to say is that I think, according to Naipaul, and I suspect he's right, that in the early 1950s, people from different parts of the Caribbean would joke about class background, racial background, one island against another. There was a kind of teasing which was very much part of how things were. Once nationalism grew and independence was looming, I think people then separated off from each other much more. The implications of saying a particular thing would have a political overtone, which maybe they wouldn't have done earlier. Initially, when West Indian Federation seemed likely to happen, they probably continued to see each other in a unified way. But when that obviously wasn't going to work, there was this sort of separation. And really, you see by certainly the early or mid-60s that the unity between those people had pretty much gone. I mean, there were individual friendships which continued, but a lot of them stopped.
In terms of around the question, I guess, of literary value and Naipaul's own sort of relationship to that, I just wonder whether you could comment on the way in which Naipaul's positioned himself as a writer, and in particular the way in which he's kind of, especially, you know, after the early phase of his career, kind of positioned himself as something of a kind of cosmopolitan writer, a rootless, you know, worldly writer.
Yeah.
Like the critic Tim Brennan, for example, suggested that Naipaul's a cosmopolitan writer who trades on the kind of ideas associated with cosmopolitanism by, as Brennan puts it, exporting an inside view of formerly submerged peoples for target reading publics in Europe and North America. So it's kind of suggesting that he trades on his kind of the fact that he has come from the Caribbean as a way of kind of accruing literary value by then criticising or having these very kind of acerbic satirical takes on those places. And it's a way of kind of, like I say, accruing literary value or positioning himself in the kind of as a kind of cosmopolitan writer. What do you think about that? Has that positioning been crucial to kind of Naipaul's consecration in a way, or do you think there's something else going on there?
I would agree with it up to a point, but I also think the idea of a targeted reading public is really not an accurate representation of the way writers actually write in practice, and that when you see people saying, well, I'm trying to have my books read by this particular demographic, they're normally going to come a cropper. So Naipaul's idea, or his view of the world, was formed very, very early. I mean, I quote things that he was writing at the age of 14, 17, when, you know, there's no substantial change between the views he was expressing aged 80. But having said that, obviously when the vogue for West Indian writing slightly faded in London in the late 50s, he at that point then did quite deliberately reposition himself. He wanted from then on to be seen as, if not exactly a British writer, then certainly somebody who was in some abstract great tradition. Although I would agree with that statement up to a point, I would also qualify it very much. Sorry, there's one other thing I was going to say, but I'll maybe come back to it.
I guess the kind of follow-on question from that, in a way, is around the wit of Naipaul, his kind of often to the point of rudeness, this satirical bite of both his writings, and you know, you've got many examples in the book of the kind of things that he says about people. How much of that is part of his kind of literary act, as it were, or part of the kind of the Trinidadian sort of Pekong tradition? How much is that part of his literary act? And also, is there a way of seeing that kind of conscious distancing of himself from pretty much everyone I think at one point you talk about the way you kind of say something, I just don't have any friends, you know, I don't want to sort of you know, get involved in that way. Seeing that as a kind of necessary complement to his efforts at kind of, again, consecrating himself through this sort of sense of, like you say, a link to some kind of abstract great tradition.
Right. Okay, so to come back to the earlier point that I was going to make, people have sometimes said, you know, to put it crudely in terms of one of the first attacks on him, I think in the late 60s, I can't remember who it was now, who said that he was a despicable lackey of imperialism.
Mm.
And, you know, this is a kind of standard critique of Naipaul, that he's simply saying what people of a reactionary tendency in Western capitals want to hear. Mm. And then following on from that, you had other attacks saying, well, he's part of the sort of resurgent Hindu nationalist tradition and that's what he's about. Mm. But I think that his moral compass or his view of the world is very much internal.
Mm.
If you read his work carefully, you will find that he will quite happily attack people or ideas or values which he should supposedly support if he did have that very narrow view.
Yeah.
So I think that his perception of the world is completely internalized. It's not something that depends on box ticking in any sense. So to come on to the second point that you were making, sorry, just recap it in one sentence.
It's just the way in which you could see his kind of that persona, that acerbic wit, as part of his literary act and as part of that attempt to kind of position himself in this abstract tradition.
Yes, I mean, I think that is a quite self-conscious positioning. Mm. Again and again, I have met people and still meet people who will tell me some story or anecdote about V.S. Naipaul. I met him and he did this and he said this, and you know, they're astonished by the fact that he was so acerbic, or he said something that was eccentric or offensive or whatever. But to be honest, a lot of those stories are much like the rest of them. To me, they're completely familiar. It's part of a psychological pattern, really, where he will speak in a particular way in order to generate a particular effect. I think I maybe said in the book at one point that it was almost like he is throwing out chaff in order to deflect attention from his writerly persona and instead to focus on these random scattergun insults which he's firing at people. I don't think the insults and the acerbic remarks are really central to the writing. If you look at the things that Naipaul has said in interviews, which have caused a great rumpus, and then you look at the actual words on the page in his books, the books are infinitely subtler and more interesting.
Yeah.
So I think it is a persona. Again, I say, in the world is what it is. It's a mask that has eaten into the face, which is inevitably what happens. You know, particularly if you transplant yourself from one country to another, you do develop or put on some kind of identity, and over time that becomes you. You know, your old friends might say it's a mask, or they might say, well, his accent has changed, but in fact it becomes something that is profoundly part of him. And I think that does come out of a larger Caribbean tradition, a Trinidadian tradition. I mean, it was really when I went there to do research and I noticed that people spoke very you know, in this way, which is kind of obnoxious, but very, very funny. Certainly people of his generation in Trinidad, when they were told, for example, about the run-in with Paul Theroux leading to his book, Savidia Shadow, they were, you know, someone like Lloyd Best.
Mm.
I mean, he said, this is how we act here. You know, it's Trinidadian entertainment. That was how he perceived it.
Interesting that you mentioned just now the way in which Naipaul may have been manoeuvred to have been read as a symbol of a resurgent Hindu nationalism. Mm. We'd also be really interested to hear, especially in light of your own work on India, your views on Naipaul's various accounts of that country.
Of India?
Yeah.
Ah, well, so his sister Kamala goes to Banaras Hindu University in the late 40s, and he writes to her as a teenage boy saying, you know, send me lots of information about these disgraceful Indians, because one day I'm going to write about them and expose all their despicable ways. And you know, he's got a take on India. He doesn't he doesn't have any doubt about that. And then finally, when he's nearly 30, he goes there for the first time, and has that experience in Bombay, which he describes beautifully in Area of Darkness, where for the first time in his life he is invisible. He's a face in the crowd. People assume he's going to speak Hindi or whatever relevant Indian languages it is. But he's somebody who can't speak those languages, so he can understand a little bit of Hindi, but he's just one of this mass of millions of people. And I think that very much forms what became an Area of Darkness. I think it is a highly insightful book. It very much upset people at the time. But I think it's interesting that if you speak to the next generation of Indian writers, most people will praise Area of Darkness. They will say, well, he was saying things which now are completely obvious about things that had gone wrong with India 15 years after independence. These very grand, ambitious dreams of Gandhi and Nehru had not been implemented. And yet at the same time, you had all these public figures in India in the 60s who were going around congratulating each other on having made a great independent nation. And then you have absurd things like Dr. Kiran Singh, the son of the last Maharaja of Kashmir, saying about Area of Darkness, you know, why is Naipaul saying that we should be building toilets? The country would be bankrupted if we were to build toilets. These kind of absurd responses to Area of Darkness. So then when he goes back and in the late 70s writes A Wounded Civilization, I find that a very interesting book, but from this distance of time, it's probably less revealing. And then in the late 80s, he writes India, A Million Mutinies Now. And I think that's very intriguing, the way that he anticipates a kind of popular resurgence of political energy, which he calls A Million Mutinies, which is then manifested in all sorts of experimental political and social programs. You could perhaps say it's manifested in the economic growth in India that happened very unexpectedly in the early and mid-1990s. And so I think A Million Mutinies Now is a very important book, because I can't think of any other book that came out either by an Indian writer or someone else writing about India in the 80s and 90s that was able to take the temperature of what was happening at that time. Many people in the late 80s were extremely pessimistic about India's future, whereas he thought the fact that people were so intellectually busy and curious was in itself bound to generate some kind of transformation. I think a little later, when he goes back and has his various encounters with the BJP, that he goes into a bit of a blind alley. But I guess the vision of India in Area of Darkness and in A Million Mutinies are both you know, visions that stand the test of time, in my opinion.
We are coming close to running out of time, but perhaps we could finish by asking a couple of questions about your current writing. Are there any Caribbean intersections or interests in any of your current projects? Or what are your future directions for work?
Oh, well, I mean, at a personal level, yes, I'm still in touch with quite a few people from different places. I went a couple of years ago to the Calabash Festival in Jamaica, which I have to say is the best literary festival I've ever been to. You know, highly responsive crowds of 1,000 or 2,000 people are not something that you'd get at an English literary festival, which would normally be a much more staid affair. So I've enjoyed that very much. I'm looking at various things at the moment. One of the things I'm looking at is the figure of Queen Victoria and her influence on the structure and development of the British Empire. And I'm interested, for example, in the Morant Bay Rebellion, which is 7 years after the Indian Rebellion or Mutiny, and the way in which the British state, to some extent guided by Victoria personally, decide to respond to unrest. You know, what sort of reforms that they make. In particular, the idea that as the white dominions like Canada and Australia become effectively independent in the late 19th century, you have places like Jamaica having their legislatures abolished, and instead they're put under effectively direct rule from London. So I'm quite interested in that process of change. and the way that ideas about the management of empire play out in different parts of the world. And, you know, one crucial part of the world, obviously, is the Caribbean.
I think that's... We can stop it there, if you like.
Lovely. It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you
very
much.
That was really great. Thank you.